Where do I even begin? Friday Night History 81, Season 3, Episode 15. The Geta. There's a lot of myths surrounding Date Masamune, Daimyo of Sendai, and a good measure of it is things he himself set in motion in life. Perhaps the biggest of this is the stories about his right eye. They get repeated a lot while missing the obvious fact that almost word for word, they repeat a story from the Romance of the Three Kingdoms, Tale of Shaohodun, and forensic analysis from the 1970s confirmed that Masamune was blind in his right eye, but kept it. Why the Romance of the Three Kingdoms fanfic? Well, because he was a cinephile, and because, in the words of the old Bob Dureau and Dave Frischberg song, baby, you can't look bad long as you're looking good. In modern terms, it was PR. But then there's some stories other people invented about Masamune in the 20th century, which frankly astound me in how often I see people repeating them as if they were historical. Which brings me to the inventor of the one we're going to discuss today. Miyamori Asataro, 1869 to 1952, was one of the first great translators of Japanese literature into English. He translated the masterpieces of the playwright Chikamatsu, for instance, along with the Kokin Wakashi poetry anthology. He also authored the Tales of the Samurai in 1920, the source of this absolutely made-up story that gets taken way too uncritically online today in English. The introduction makes it clear that they're fictionalized, though. The opening two sentences read, quote, "The following tales of the samurai, the knights of old Japan, are based largely on real facts. They have been adapted from among traditional stories related by kodansha, storytellers, who nightly delight large audiences with romances and historical stories, especially the noble deeds of the samurai." End quote. Note that word, largely. Largely based on real facts. That's doing quite a bit of heavy lifting there. And while I think you should read this book, I want you to keep that in mind. This is not history. This is more of a heavily fictionalized morality play. The term Miyamori invokes in the preface for what kind of story this is kodan, storytelling with dramatic delivery. Now, this is fine, sure, and we have our share for it in the United States. The story about George Washington chopping down the cherry tree, for instance, is something along those lines. And, of course, historical fiction is a genre. But we want to be conscientious consumers of media, and like I've said many times, writing historical fiction requires due diligence. Looking at you, James Clavell. And then there's the things that just beggar the imagination if you know a little bit about the facts, like Ungo Zenji, the opening story in the series. Here it is in full, because I want you to hear Miyamori in his own words. It was snowing fast. Already as far as the eye could see, the world was covered with a vast silvery sheet. Hill and dale, tree and field, all alike, clothed in virgin white. Caring nothing for the bitter cold, but loving the beautiful, Date Masamune determined to go out to enjoy the scene. Accordingly, accompanied by a few attendants, he wended his way to a pavilion set on a low hill in the castle grounds, whence an extensive view, embracing the whole of his little fief of Osaki, could be obtained. In later life, Masamune distinguished himself as signal service rendered to the state, eventually becoming one of the greatest daimyos in Japan under Ieyasu, the first shogun, but at this time Osaki was his sole estate, and his income did not exceed 100,000 koku of rice a year. "What an enchanting picture! What can compare with this snow landscape?" he exclaimed, as he stood enraptured, gazing with delight from the balcony of the pavilion at the pure loveliness of the scene before him. "It is said that snow foretells a fruitful year. When the harvest is abundant, great is the rejoicing of the people, and peace and prosperity reign over the land." While his lordship thus soliloquized, Heishiro the Sandal-Bearer, Makabe Heishiro as he was called from his birthplace, Makabe in Hitachi, a surname being a luxury unknown to the Third Estate, waited without. Having adjusted his master's footgear, there was nothing more to do till he should come out again. But presently Heishiro observed that the snowflakes fell and lay somewhat thick on his valuable charge. He hastened to brush them off with his sleeve, but more flakes fell, and again the geta, clogs, were covered with icy particles. "This will never do," he said to himself. His lordship disdains to wear tabi socks, even in the coldest weather, deeming it a mark of effeminacy. Should he place his bare feet on these damp geta, he will assuredly catch cold. I must keep them warm and dry for him. So the good fellow, in the kindness of his simple heart, took up the heavy clogs, and putting them in the bosom of his garment next to his skin, continued his patient waiting. His lordship comes! Heishiro had just time to put the geta straight on the large stone step at the entrance before the double doors slid open right and left, and Masamune appeared, young, imperious. He slipped his feet onto the geta. How was this? They felt warm to his touch. How could they be that in such freezing weather? There could be but one explanation. That lazy lout of a sandal-bearer had been using them as a seat, sitting on the honorable footgear of his august master. The insufferable insolence of the fellow! In the passion at the supposed insult, he caught the offender by the nape of his neck and shook him violently, exclaiming between his set teeth, "You scoundrel! How dared you defile my geta by sitting on them? You have grossly insulted me behind my back. Villain, take that!" Catching up one of the clogs which he had kicked off, he struck the poor servitor a heavy blow between the eyes, which caused him to reel stunned and bleeding to the ground. Then, hurling the companion geta at his prostrate victim, he strode proudly back to the castle, barefooted, for he was in too great a rage to wait until another pair of geta could be brought. No one stayed to look after Heishiro. None cared what became of him. For some time he lay as he had fallen, but presently the cold brought him back to consciousness, and he rose slowly and with difficulty to his feet. He picked up the geta with which he had been struck, and with tears mingling with the blood on his face, he gazed at it mournfully for a few moments. Then, as the thought of his master's injustice came over him, he gnashed his teeth in impotent rage. "Haughty brute that you are, Masamune," he muttered. "You shall pay for this. The bond between us as lord and vassal has snapped forever. I have been one of the most devoted of your humble servants, but now I will never rest until I have had my revenge on you for this cruel treatment." Then Heishiro again put the geta into his bosom, though with how different an intention from before, and descending the hill on the side furthest from the castle, limped painfully away. From that time forth the man had but one idea, to wreak condign vengeance on the arrogant noble who had so abused his kindness. But Masamune was a daimyo, though a poor one, while Heishiro was only a serf. Assassination was impossible, Masamune always being well guarded even while he slept, besides possessing considerable bodily strength himself. He must have recourse to other and subtler means. He thought long and deeply. There were only two persons of higher rank than the daimyo who could affect his position at will, the emperor and the shogun. But how could a man of Heishiro's standing gain the ear of either of these two illustrious personages so as to slander Masamune and influence them against him? The very idea was absurd. True, it was a warlike age, and promotion speedily followed the achievement of a deed of valor. With a spear in his hand and a good horse under him, one might rise to almost any height. But Heishiro was no soldier, and his physical strength was small. With a sigh, he admitted to himself that the accomplishment of his purpose did not lie that way. And then a happy thought struck him. He remembered that anyone, high or low, great or small, could become a priest, and that the prospects held out in that profession were boundless. There was no distinction to which a man of the lowliest parentage and the weakest body might not aspire. A learned priest with a reputation for sanctity might get access to the court, gain the notice of the emperor himself. That was it. Heishiro resolved to turn priest, and with this in view, he made all haste to Kyoto, where he entered the temple of Ungoji in Higashiyama as an acolyte. But the career of an acolyte is none of the easiest. Before he can be received into the priesthood, he must go through all forms of asceticism, self-denial, and penance. Furthermore, he has to serve his superiors as a drudge, doing the most menial tasks at their command. Heishiro had a very hard time of it. A man of ordinary perseverance might have succumbed and given up. Not so Heishiro. Not for a moment did he dream of abandoning his self-imposed task. He was determined, as long as there was life in him, to endure every hardship and humiliation, so that eventually he might attain his end. Still, he was but human, and there were times when his weary body almost gave way and his spirit flagged. His racked nerves seemed as if they could bear no more. At such times, he would look in a mirror at the reflection of the deep scar on his brow and draw from its place of concealment the odd garden geta, saying to himself, "Courage, remember Masamune, your work is not done yet." The strength and calmness would return, and he once more felt equal to labor and endure. Little by little, Heishiro rose in favor of his superiors, and his learning showed marked progress. At length, he thought he might get on faster if he went to another monastery, and the temple of Enryaku-ji on Mount Hiei being the largest and most renowned of all places of sacred learning in Japan, he applied there for admission and was readily admitted. 20 years later, Jōben, for that was the name Heishiro took on entering the priesthood, was known to far and near for his erudition and strict application to all observances of a life of the most austere piety. But he was not satisfied. He was still very far from being in a position to attract the notice of the emperor. Yet higher he must climb. To be world famous was his aim. So he made up his mind to go over to China, justly regarded as the fountainhead of all knowledge and wisdom. All she could impart of the Buddhistic faith he would acquire. As soon as an opportunity afforded, Jōben sailed from his native shores and found himself among a strange people. Here he remained 10 years. During that time, he visited many famous temples and gathered wisdom from many sources. At last, the fame of the traveler reached the ear of the Chinese emperor, who was pleased to grant him an audience and graciously bestowed upon him a new sacerdotal name, that of Issan Kasho Daizenji. Thus it came about that Jōben left his country acknowledged, indeed, to be a wise and holy man, but he came back to be regarded as the foremost divine in Japan. After his return, Issan Kasho Daizenji stayed at Ungoji, the temple in Kyoto, where he had entered on his novitiate. He had heard nothing of Masamune for some years and was anxious to learn what had become of him. He was unpleasantly surprised to hear that the object of his hatred had also risen in the world, and that now, as the lord of the castle of Sendai, he was considered one of the most important men of the day. Not only did he hold high office at court, but as the head of the northeastern daimyos, even the shogun had to treat him with respect. All this was annoying, if nothing worse. The Zenji saw that he would have to bide his time and act warily. A false move now might render futile all his long years of travail, but after all, he did not have to wait long. The emperor was taken ill, and his malady was of so serious a nature that the skill of the wisest physicians proved of no avail. The highest officials of the imperial household met in solemn conclave to discuss the matter, and it was decided that the earthly means being vain, the only hope lay in an appeal to heaven. Who was the priest of character so stainless, of wisdom so profound, that he might be entrusted with this high mission? One name rose to all lips, Issan Kasho Daizenji. With all speed, therefore, the holy man was summoned to the palace and ordered to pray his hardest to the heavenly powers for the restoration to health of the imperial patient. For 7 days and 7 nights, the Zenji isolated himself from all mankind in the Hall of the Blue Dragon. For 7 days and 7 nights he fasted and prayed that the precious life might be spared, and his prayers were heard. At the end of that time, the emperor took a turn for the better, and so rapid was his recovery that in a very short time all cause of anxiety about him was over. His Majesty's gratitude knew no bounds. The Zenji was honored with many marks of the imperial regard, and as a consequence all the ministers and courtiers vied with each other in obsequiousness to the favorite of the emperor. He was appointed head of Ungoji Temple and received yet another name, Ungo Daizenji. "The attainment of my desire is now within reach," thought the priest exultantly. "It only remains to find a plausible pretext for accusing Masamune of high treason." But more than 30 years had elapsed since Makabe Heishiro, the lowly sandal-bearer, had vowed vengeance on the daimyo Date Masamune, and not without effect had been his delving into holy scriptures, his long vigils, his life of asceticism and meditation. Heishiro had become Ungo Daizenji, a great priest. His character had undergone a radical change, though he had not suspected it. His mind had been purified and was now incapable of harboring so mean and paltry a feeling as a desire for revenge. Now that the power was within his grasp, he no longer cared to exercise it. "To hate or to try to injure a fellow creature is below one who has entered the priesthood," he said to himself. "The winds of passion disturb only those who move about the maze of the secular world. When a man's spiritual eyes are opened, neither east nor west, neither north nor south exists. Such things are but illusions. I have nursed a grudge against Lord Date for over 30 years, and with the sole object of revenge before my eyes have raised myself to my present position. But if Lord Date had not ill-treated me on a certain occasion, what would my life have been? I should probably have remained Heishiro the Sandal-Bearer all my days. But my lord had the unkindness to strike me with a garden geta without troubling himself to find out whether I deserved such chastisement. I was roused to anger and vowed to be revenged. Because of my resolve to punish him, I turned priest, studied hard, endured privations, and so at length have become one of the most influential priests in the empire, before whom even princes and nobles bow with reverence. If I look at the matter in its true light, it is to Lord Date that I owe everything. In olden times, Shakyamuni, turning his back on earthly glory, climbed Mount Dantoku and there served his novitiate with Saint Arara. Prince though he was, he performed all menial offices for his master, who, if ever the disciple seemed negligent, would beat him with a cane. How mortifying it is, thought the royal neophyte, that I, born to a throne, should be treated thus by one so far beneath me in rank. But Shakyamuni was a man of indomitable spirit. The more humiliations he had to suffer, the more earnestly did he apply himself to his religious studies, so that at the early age of 30 he had learnt all his teacher could impart, and himself began to teach, introducing to the world one of the great religions it has ever known. It may truthfully be said that Shakya's success was largely, if not wholly, due to the stern and relentless master who allowed no shirking of his work. Far be it from me to institute any comparison between my humble self and the holy founder of Buddhism, but nevertheless I cannot deny the fact that the pavilion in the grounds of Osaki Castle was my Mount Dantoku, and this old garden geta my Saint Arara's cane. Therefore it should be gratitude, not revenge, that I have in my heart for Masamune, for it was his unconsidered act that laid the foundation of my prosperity. Thus the good priest relinquished his long-cherished idea of vengeance, and a better feeling took its place. He now looked upon the blood-stained geta with reverence, offering flowers and burning incense before it, while day and night he prayed fervently for the long life and happiness of his old master, Lord Date Masamune. And Masamune himself? As stated above, he attained great honors and became a leading man in the councils of his country. But at the age of 63, he tired of public life and retired to pass the evening of his days in his castle of Sendai. Here to employ his leisure, he set about the restoration of the well-known temple of Zuiganji at Matsushima in the vicinity of the castle, which during a long period of civil strife had fallen into decay, being in fact a complete ruin. Masamune took it upon himself to restore the building to its former rich splendor, and then when all was done, looked about for a priest of deep learning and acknowledged virtue who should be worthy to be placed in charge of it. At a gathering of his chief retainers, he addressed them as follows. As you know, I have rebuilt and decorated the Zuiganji Temple in this vicinity, but it still remains without a superior. I desire to entrust it to a holy and learned man who will carry on its ancient traditions as a seat of piety. Tell me, who is the greatest priest of the day? Ungo Zenji, high priest of the Ungoji Temple in Kyoto, is undoubtedly the greatest priest of the day, came the unanimous reply. So Masamune decided to offer the vacant post to the holy Ungo Daizenji, but as the priest in question was a favorite at court and enjoyed the confidence of the emperor, it was necessary that his majesty should first be approached before anything was said to the Zenji. Masamune tendered his petition in due form and as a personal favor to himself. The emperor, who retained a warm affection for the retired statesman, readily assented, and thus it came about that Ungo Zenji was appointed head of the Zuiganji Temple in the beautiful district of Matsushima. On the seventh day after his installation, Masamune paid a formal call at the Zuiganji to welcome the new arrival. He was ushered into the private guest room of the Zenji, which was at the moment unoccupied. On turning to the alcove, his attention was at once arrested by the sight of an old garden geta placed on a valuable stand of elaborate and costly workmanship. "What celebrated personage has used that geta?" said the astonished Masamune to himself. "But surely it is a breach of etiquette to decorate a room with such a lowly article when about to receive a daimyo of my standing. However, the priest has doubtless some purpose in allowing so strange an infringement of good manners." At that moment, the sliding doors opened noiselessly, and a venerable man in full canonicals and bearing a holy brush of long white hair in his hand came in. His immobile face was that of an ascetic, but marred by a disfiguring scar on his forehead between the eyes. Ungo Zenji, for he it was, seated himself opposite his guest, and putting both hands, palm downwards, on the mats, bowed several times in respectful greeting, Masamune returning courtesy with due ceremony. When the salutations were over, Masamune could no longer restrain his curiosity. "Your reverence," he began, "in compliance with my earnest request, you have condescended to come down to this insignificant place to take charge of our temple. I am profoundly impressed by your goodness and know not how to thank you. I am a plain man and unskilled in words. But, your reverence, there are two things which puzzle me, and though at this our first interview you may deem it a want of good breeding to be so inquisitive, may I ask you to explain the place of honor given to a guard in Geta, and the scar on your brow which accords so ill with your reputation for saintliness?" At these words, poured out with the impetuosity he remembered in Masamune as a young man, the priest smiled a little. Then he withdrew to the lower end of the apartment, with tears glistening in his sunken eyes, said, "How rejoiced I am to see your face again. To gaze upon your unchanged features reminds me of the days of my long past youth." "What? Your words are strange. How can I remind you of your youth, when, to my knowledge, we never met till this day?" "My lord, have patience, and I will explain all," replied the Zenji. "In those days I was but a servant, a sandal-bearer known as Makabe Heishiro. It is not likely so humble an individual would retain a place in your memory. It was when you were residing at the castle of Osaki." He paused, but Masamune, too amazed to utter a word, only looked intently at his former servant, as if trying to recall having ever seen him before. So Ungo Zenji went on with his story, and in detail told all that had befallen him since that snowy day more than 30 years before. He did not spare himself, but told how through all those years he had been actuated by a feeling of revenge and revenge only, and how the thought of someday seeing his enemy in the dust had been the spur to goad him on to conquer all difficulties, to surmount every obstacle. "At length," concluded the priest, "I came under the notice of the emperor, who so magnified a trifling service that he loaded me with rewards and marks of favor. Now is my time, I thought, but to my own astonishment I found that so vile a passion no longer existed in my nature. The desire for revenge had fled. I began to view the affair in a different light, and to look upon you as my benefactor. But for you I would still be the sandal-bearer for you. The stores of knowledge at my command would never have come within my reach. But for you, the intercourse I have had with the illustrious and sage men of two countries would have been an impossibility. Therefore, my hatred is turned to gratitude, my wish for vengeance to a heartfelt desire for your long life and prosperity. I pray daily that someday I may be enabled in some small measure to requite the inestimable benefits I owe to you. Your lordship now understands why I so treasure an old Geta, and how it is that I bear this ugly scar on my brow." Masamune listened to the narrative with growing wonder and the deepest attention. At its conclusion, he rose, and taking the Zenji by both hands gently but forcibly, drew him to the upper end of the apartment. When both were again seated, he spoke. "Your reverence," he said in a voice full of emotion, "what you have just told me puts me quite out of countenance. I can just recall the incident of which you speak, and I remember how angry I felt at what in my arrogance I deemed a gross insult. I do not wonder at your desire for revenge, but that you should renounce the triumph that was yours for the asking. That, indeed, amazes me. Such magnanimity is almost incredible. You prove to me that religion is not the empty abstraction some call it, and I humbly beg your pardon for my past offense, and request you to enroll me as one of your disciples." In this way, Masamune, who was of a frank and noble disposition, repented of the fault committed in his youth, and the sandal-bearer achieved a greater glory than he could have boasted of had he caused his enemy to die a shameful death. A hearty friendship sprang up between the two generous-minded men, until death parted them many years later. They saw much of each other, and their affection grew. The priest was always a welcome guest at the castle, while, with earnest piety, Masamune prosecuted his studies in sacred lore, under the guidance of Ungo Zenji. The end. Okay, let's take a breath. There's a problem here right off the bat. Makabe no Heishiro and Ungo Zenji are two different people several centuries apart. I know, but stay with me. Zuiganji is one of the most famous historical sites on Sendai Bay, east of Sendai proper. It's the temple of which the song Saitarabushi says, and this I can sing because it's in public domain, Matsushima no sayo Zuiganji hodo no tera mo nai toe. There is no temple quite like Zuiganji of Matsushima. Zuiganji Temple is the name of the temple today, but as originally founded, the temple was a Tendai sect temple named Enpukuji in the 9th century. It switched sects to the Rinzai sect during the Kamakura era, when a 13th century monk named Hoshin Seisai was its abbot. Hoshin Seisai was once a sandal bearer named Heishiro serving the Jito, the land steward, of Makabe in Hitachi province, Makabe Tokimoto. It was Makabe Tokimoto who threw the geta at Heishiro's head and set all of this in motion. And Heishiro swore vengeance and did some of what we saw in the story, even going to China to study. And mind you, this was China during the Song Dynasty, not the late Ming Dynasty, which ruled China during Masamune's lifetime. Enpukuji had fallen into disrepair during the Muromachi era, though, when Masamune became lord of the Sendai domain several centuries later. And it was by his will to his son Tadamune that a different monk, Ungo Zenji, was summoned to be the abbot of the restored temple, which was now called Zuiganji. So Masamune was already dead when Ungo Zenji became abbot of Zuiganji. When Masamune was still in his early career, during the time frame that Miyamori's story is set, the future Ungo Zenji was 9 years old and still in southern Japan. So in terms of time and in terms of geography, this is just not believable as anything attempting to be a retelling of history. There's also other issues. Japan didn't have such a thing as serfs. There was no castle called Osaki in Masamune's domain. 100,000 koku is not a small domain. Koku were not the standard measure of daimyo's domain in Masamune's youth. In the Edo period, Zuiganji wasn't close to the city of Sendai. There was no shogun when Masamune was a young daimyo. Masamune was known for being flamboyant, and the stuff that Miyamori calls effeminacy wasn't something he was particularly shying away from, and so on and so on and so on and so on. But here's the other issue, which actually was my first inkling that something about this story didn't smell right. Masamune saw himself as a Taoist sage. This is why he named his castle town Sendai, City of Immortals. What's more, we know about his personal home life because of records including that left by one of his attendants, a man named Kimura Uemon, and cruelty to people who waited on him was not something Masamune did. While Masamune certainly had his moments of being petty and cruel, he had other ways of doing it, and throwing geta at the face of a servant is not something that fits with what we know about him. And finally, because having visual evidence can help, check out the blog post for a side-by-side depiction of the 13th century monk Hoshin Seisai and the 17th century monk Ungo Zenji, the former a painting, the latter a sculpture. Both of them Buddhist monastics of high attainment, both of them abbots of the temple now called Zuiganji, but only one of them was a former sandal bearer. Miyamori's story tells us more about the time Miyamori was writing in, as well as the audience of foreigners for whom he was writing, than it helps us learn anything about Masamune, Ungo Zenji, or Hoshin Seisai. As with Parson Weems writing heavily fictionalized stories about George Washington, the idea was to be morally instructive to the people of his time, and in this case, to present that moral instruction to the rest of the world. Now, this was not the first time anybody in the West post-1853 would have heard of Masamune. That distinction likely belongs, rather unfortunately, to South Carolinian Collier Merriweather, of whom we've spoken on this podcast before. And yet, we have to give credit where credit is due, because this is an important point in the history of English language writing about Masamune. And despite distorting the man's character and multiple centuries of regional and religious history, there is still some measure of the truth here, which reached a very broad audience far beyond Japan. But like Miyamori said, these stories are largely based on real facts. Let's just be mindful that fiction is not the same as history, and that we can do better today in what we write, and that we can try to be conscientious consumers of popular culture, new or old. And with that, I will see you next week. I'm Nairi, and this has been Friday Night History. Now, questions? Friday Night History is a historical romp with me, your favorite history dyke, Dr. Nairi A. Bakalyan. Our theme is Ohayashi from Paratune, licensed under CC 4.0. This podcast is brought to you by my Patreon patrons, so thank you to Sorcha, Catherine, Emily, Eric, Jan, Bob, Ryan, Sean, Ennis, Faith, JD, Kaz, Rita, Dinsdale, ALC, AO65, Amy, Daphne, Dr. Yakumo, Lemur, Gnarl, Irene, Jesse, Catherine, Katie, Laura, Maeve, Mark, Nora, Sinan, Aura, Bewick, Charlene, Charles, Danny, Deborah, Emily D, Emily R, Julie, Gabe, Jacob, Jax, Jocelyn, Kathy, Kim, Mary, Phoebe, Phoebe Z, Relia, Rueri, Lisa, Susan, Tora, Zandra, Allison, Amy, Andrick, Bruce, Charlotte, Colin, Flitterkit, Jack, Kelly, Lane, Natalie, Fuong, Planes, Sam, Samantha, Vera, Ines, and Zoe. I couldn't have done it without you. Thank you so much, and remember, who you are and what lights your fire is worth fighting for. North Star forever. I'll see you around.